Hello and welcome to episode 156 of the Crate and Crowbar. It is the, I forgot to look at the date before saying this, 6th of September 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Pip War.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
News this week, as for the first time ever, people are upset in computer games.
How could this be?
Specifically, and even more unprecedentedly, they're upset about DLC
for Not computer again. Games.
Not only that. But the DLC costs money. And Tom, I'm going to blow your mind. This also concerns a game in early access.
Oh no! It's the Venn diagram of shite. Aligned like a solstice of
tick off your bingo cards. Ladies and gentlemen.
All the worst things have happened.
We've got ourselves a big old drama. This week's drama of exactly this sort.
Yeah.
Concerns Ark Survival Evolved.
What have they done, Chris?
What have they done? I found out about this literally 30 seconds ago, so I can't pretend to be an expert.
They are charging money for the Scorched Earth expansion of their video game.
The Scorched Earth expansion, they're charging money for it, but that's not the reason for the controversy, because people have just about swallowed the idea that you pay for stuff. They're annoyed, and maybe rightly, we shall discuss that, because Ark is still technically in early access. It is listed as an early access game on Steam. I mean, this despite the fact that it's very well supported. And I don't say that because the updates are good. I say that because I get a lot of emails about it.
And also the fans seem genuinely happy to play it all the time, a lot. And there are lots of kind of YouTube support. I see lots of streams for it. And people seem generally happy with the game.
It's usually hovering in or around the Steam top 10 as well.
Yeah.
But I think one of the quote that I saw floating around today was essentially about, because I haven't kept track of the schedule that they were supposed to be on or if there was one, but one of the quotes I saw today was about, you know, all of the other kind of stuff, the side projects and DLC and whatever else, like pushing the game off schedule, which that feels like maybe a bit more of a valid concern. In terms of, you know, if you've signed up to a thing and the devs seem to be, you know, really dedicated to it, and then you do see them maybe go off and do the, like, is Survival of the Fittest a different game? Because that was mentioned at E3.
They have, like, an esports thing. My knowledge is entirely based on press releases I've received.
Oh, fair enough.
So I can tell you about initiatives.
But like, so maybe it's best if we sort of talk in generalities then.
Yes.
Because for me, I would only buy something in early access if I was happy if it never moved any further along the development, because that feels like the lowest risk approach to early access, I guess. So when I bought Subnautica, it was sort of because I was happy that I would get something from it for that money, even if they announce the next day, do you know what? We're not going to do it. We just can't.
I think that would be slightly outrageous, though, because I think there's an implicit promise with the early access format that the game will be improved and moved towards a completed status. And that's what people are buying into for a lower price.
There is, but I think that's the only way that I can think to approach it without getting burned, if you see what I mean.
For sure.
So it's very much that's the lowest risk possible approach. But I have seen, I do understand that there is that understanding, and there is a kind of, I don't know if it would be a legal contract. I guess it would depend on the wording of the, you know, the thing that you sign up to when you pay your money. But I do think that you have to, you know, there needs to be an understanding of what you get and when and what's reasonable, and I guess if there is any repercussions. Because, you know, if this thing doesn't get made, what can anyone
do about it?
Or if it doesn't get finished?
The thing is, like, this stuff, I feel like we had resolved, not like we, but like, you know, games community had gotten used to the idea of early access, which stemmed from the idea of getting used to Kickstarter, which was a similar set of problems. And parallel to that, people got used to DLC. And so there is an assumption that, yeah, like people, know what they're getting into with early access, and you know, things might not progress according to plan and so on. And DLC, paid DLC, which was itself controversial originally, one of the reasons that that got kind of rationalized, justified after games, a lot of people were used to games getting free updates, was, well, this is work that is being done fresh after the game is out, so you're paying for the new effort, and that's fair enough. And then that led to the controversy of a day one DLC, where the upset was because, well, if you were making this while you were making the game, why isn't it in the box? And then the justification was, well, this is stuff we could do after the game had gone gold, when that was when the CDs were being printed, and we had a couple of, and you know, it was off for QA testing or something, and we had a couple of months to work on new stuff. So again, it's not part of that original, you know, bundle of effort that you're buying when you buy the game. Whereas I can kind of see where people are upset in this case, because paid DLC for a game that is in early access is a weird, it's like it short circuits those two different angry tracks and makes them fight each other.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a weird one.
I think, instinctively, I think it's dreadful to do that to an audience that has bought into an early access game where they've, like in their little early access segment on Steam, so that they're going to continuously work on this and make it, you know, a fully polished product. And what I see happening all the time in early access is that they make these promises and there's no kind of time track on it, and there are no consequences for just not doing the work or not actually bringing it up to that standard. And people are buying into this with that expectation, definitely. And I think Pip's wise to go in with that mindset of, look, I'm going to get this. I'm going to enjoy this as is and not expect anything else. But that, I think that's not what is promised by the early access format.
Yeah, that's fair.
That what is promised is a complete game at some point. And it can be kind of presumptuous of audiences to assume they know how a studio is allocating its resources in order to produce DLC packs or expansions or developmental bugs fixing. But if people have genuine gripes with bugs and problems with the game and in early access, and the studio aren't fixing them, and then they're also charging like however much money for this other DLC pack to expand it, then I would be quite irritated if I'd invested in that product.
I feel like maybe I've just worn out my anger gland like the last few weeks, and because everything that you've just said makes sense, and I just don't feel angry. And I feel like that feels like a failing on my part.
If I'd have paid £20, I'd feel angry. Like I think, yeah. I'm putting myself in that position of having of those expectations and what this announcement would do to those expectations.
Yeah, and I think it does trample the goodwill that you that it felt like Ark had actually built up with its player base, because they were, you know, pretty evangelical and vocal and, you know, into the game. Right?
And a lot of the rhetoric around, not Ark specifically, but around a lot of these games is that the community is part of the development. The community feedback is what's actually going back into it. And, you know, the community keeps on saying, wouldn't it be great if characters didn't sink into the floor and disappear 50 feet down into a grey space? And then that doesn't get fixed for it. This isn't Ark specifically. I'm just talking about general shonkiness that exists in a lot of these early access survival games. Commissioned a piece by Holly Nielsen of how they're basically just going into various survival games that have been in early access for its various degrees of time. And she just came back from 7 Days to Die, and she was like, oh, it looks horrible. Loads of it doesn't work. It's really shonky. All the interactions are bad. And that game has been in early access for nearly 3 years now, coming up on December. God. And the community was expecting a lot of these very basic things to be fixed. And it feels like the way that early access makes money and the way that early access is a useful crutch for well-meaning indie developers, nonetheless has resulted as a side effect in a lowering of quality across the board for certain types of game, where certain levels of shonkiness, certain levels of, you know, bugs, things just bumping into each other and not working are now just kind of okay because people get away with it and it's fine. And maybe those, you know, people should be called out more for not actually pursuing polishing their games properly.
I wonder if it'll be one of those things where there will be a big case of this, like a lawsuit attached to it, or, you know, something of that nature, or of a massive scale that will force something to change, either for the industry to sort of self-regulate and have a definition of early access, or for Steam to have a definition of early access that you adhere to, or for you know, US or UK law to step in and go, okay, that's not a thing, and this is what, you know, this is the contract that exists between the buyer and the, I mean, I think elements of it would actually be covered by actual existing law, but maybe people just don't, you know, that it's too much hassle and too much, you know, jurisdictional sort of.
I think the promise is so vague most of the time that it can't necessarily be punished by law. So if you're promising a certain degree of product by a certain time, then maybe that's false advertising or it doesn't come to fruition. But that's not what's happening. It's just a generic promise of, we will continue to work on this and be really passionate about it, and one day it will be amazing.
Or if it's just mismanaged, or if the thing, like, I guess, what are the...
There are loads of honest reasons why it can go. I'm not at all suggesting that any of this is dishonest. I mean, it's just that games are hard to make and they change a lot. And if it's a really small team, and maybe an inexperienced team, that isn't terribly well project managed, these things can just become like endless rolling year upon year development projects. But there comes a point where the audience isn't getting what they've paid for. So it's quite thorny.
I think the most likely thing to happen is that phrases like early access will lose their meaning. Like, you know, maybe eventually people just stop seeing it as anything other than buying a game when you want to buy it, and some games are shonky and some games aren't, and some games get a certain amount of support and some games don't. That seems to be the way that Valve would more likely be to take this, rather than, because regulation isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
But quietly snipping the disclaimer off early access games just to make it even less of a, less clear. Let it be more of a soup of expectations, and in doing so, remove anyone's ability to go, well, you said this, so this.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see more regulation really at all, because I think that a lot of projects like Dwarf Fortress has been early access forever, right? I mean, but there's obvious progress being made in that, but there's no way you can legislate around, oh, if you've stated this much progress must be achieved, otherwise X legal reprimand happens. That's mad. But at the same time, buyer beware doesn't seem to apply in the same way, because it feels like people are being misled by the level of development they can expect from a lot of these projects. So maybe it is just Pip's solution is correct, and just kind of take it as it is, and you know, roll with it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think mine's just a response to the fact that so much of it is unknown, or so much of, you know, you don't know how an unknown studio is going to, like, use that money, or what their pipeline is going to be, or, you know, anything like that. So I think that's more a strategy born out of necessity. You know, I'd love to sort of go, oh, that looks amazing, and you say that you'll do it in 2 years. Okay, sure. You know, actually, you mentioned people buying in for cheaper, and sort of that being, it was interesting, because usually there's a bit of a trade-off in terms of benefits and in terms of participating and sort of cheaper pricing and things like that. Although I encountered an early access game during the week. I think it was still in alpha, maybe, called Eco, and it's to do with simulating ecosystems. It's kind of, you know, you'll have a server and you'll have it almost Minecraft-y kind of voxel world, and then every interaction that you have with the world has consequences. So, you know, if you build a factory, there's pollution and you need to deal with that, and it sounds really, really ambitious, to the point where I'm really not, you know, cautious, I guess. But that, the reason that I'm mentioning it here is because the early access to that is $40, and in their FAQ they say that it's that much because they only want people to play who really want to be involved and who really want it, because that sort of thing would suffer massively from griefing, because, you know, if you have these worlds and it's perfectly capable to have server permadeath if you pollute it too badly, then, you know, you do only want the the most sort of dedicated people. But then again, that's, you know, financially, like they've paid $40 to help develop a game.
Yeah. And also, I mean, we're approaching this for with years working in the industry under our belts, like, and you can't expect that degree of knowledge of game development and how game development can change and go wrong from, I think, your average customer who just wants a piece of entertainment and they're paying for it. And I think a lot of these things they're presented in well-meaning ways. Like, I think the developers really believe they're going to achieve what's going to happen, but you see a lot of the time, like having worked in this industry for a bit, that they're just deluded about what they think they can achieve in a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Particularly when it comes to, we're going to make this MMO and it's going to be like EVE Online, but everything's going to be malleable. And like, I've heard that so many times.
Yeah.
I've heard it so many times and it's just bollocks. It's just, I think, like, I wouldn't say that to them because, like, you know, it's their business, but
you sometimes want to.
It is just bollocks. You're not going to do that. You've got a team of 30 people, mate. It's not going to happen. You can't do that. And these people are then going on to customers and trying to put that on them. And the customers don't necessarily know that that's bollocks. Like, the customers think, oh, that sounds fucking amazing. I want to invest in that. Sounds great.
Yeah. Like, the issue with that game not existing was no one else had thought of it.
Right.
It's hard.
Yes. It's really hard to do.
I remember like a 3-person team that wanted to build essentially an entire, you know, world with different biomes and different technologies and trading and like politics. And I was just like, I can't deal with this right now. I haven't had enough coffee.
I spoke to a designer, like a really passionate smart designer who's doing a sandbox game, pretty early into the job, which would be like 5-6 years ago now. And they said that their game would be pretty much done within the year, and it's still in alpha development to this day.
Oh my goodness.
I won't name it, but like, and that's not uncommon. That's not uncommon at all.
Yeah.
Is there a moral to this story?
It's just a mess, really. It's just a mess. I think consumers lose out. And I think developers, it's a very useful financial crutch for a lot of developers. And some developers use it very, very well and execute early access programs incredibly well and get out there and their games are great. And like, was Invisible Ink in early access?
Yeah.
And that was just, they used it perfectly. They just
benefited massively from it as well.
Absolutely. And there are, so you don't want to say like, this is a bad thing generally, because it's amazing sometimes.
I think one of the sort of maybe sobering things as well is that games used to come out when, you know, even when there were publishers getting the way to ostensibly, you know, set some standards, and those games had to be pitched and sold to retailers who had to carry the boxes, and there were all these formal processes in place to stop people just shipping anything.
Mm.
And, you know, plenty of games did not work in the era of, you know, serious retail things coming in cardboard boxes. Like, plenty of games did not work. Plenty of developers put out stuff way before it was ready for whatever reason. Mm. And that essentially hasn't changed. And so to a degree, The specific context of this problem is something introduced by digital distribution and the way the industry's changed over the last 10 years, really, if not more. But it seems there's maybe an argument that this is just the same problems that game software has always had, just at a much bigger scale, and equally with a much, with like everything else in the world, the potential for people to group up around an issue like this and amplify their voices in a way that simply wasn't, you know, possible. Like, I'm thinking if the person who buys a game from a secondhand game shop in 1997 and finds that it doesn't work because the developer put it out too early or something, or it wasn't compatible with their particular version of Windows 95 or something.
Yeah, I feel like those people are better protected in that instance now, in that, not just in refund terms, but in terms of just, you can't missell things rampantly in that way, like, anymore. People obviously used to put system specs and stuff on the boxes, but a lot of the time there would just be quirks and reasons that it wouldn't work at all. Like, it used to be dreadful, actually, back in the floppy disk and CD-ROM days. There was just a load of shit out there. But I don't think they'd get away with that now if they were kind of going...
No, I don't. And one of the reasons is what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's necessarily even a force for good. It's just that now, if that kind of mistake leads to the things we're talking about now, it leads to people discussing the flaws with your games on podcasts and writing articles about it, and then there are articles that respond to the article, and then articles about the Twitter campaign that was launched in response to the article, and so on.
And the change.org petition.
And the change.org petition. Stop forgetting that. Yeah, exactly.
That 64 people have signed.
Oh, one more.
Yeah, you know, nowadays, people who really care about a subject have the option to listlessly refresh petitions, desperate for a sense of...
It's a sort of justice. It's a form of justice, I suppose. But, yeah, I don't know. I suppose we'll all complain about this on future podcasts.
Well, that's the thing, partly, though. It's like, you know, we ended up having a moratorium on talking about early access and Kickstarters because that discussion dominated the podcast, the old podcast particularly, for years.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think we'd all gotten past it, and then it's just this new interesting wrinkle in the are you being shafted, in the ongoing game of are you being shafted.
Yeah, and this time dinosaurs are involved.
Yeah, which is not to be confused with Sir, you are being shafted. Which is actually a good game. So,
I was thinking more of the remake of Are You Being Served, which I think just started.
Yeah, that's a better, yeah, it's a better reference, actually.
But yes.
Anyway.
I don't think we've really,
we've resolved really nothing.
No, well, we never do anything with these discussions, but they're gratifying to have.
That's true.
Sure.
Once a year, annual discussion about are we being shafted?
Nice.
This year's verdict, still yes.
Sometimes.
Frequency varies. Pip, what have you been playing?
Oh, okay.
Oh dear.
Well, I mean, no, you sounded exasperated.
No, it's really hot.
Yes, well, I've been playing Seasons After Fall, which is a foresty, platformy, spiritually...
This is not how you
Metroidvania-ish.
This is not how you described it to me earlier, Pip, when I asked you what you were playing.
Yeah, but we don't know.
Okay. I'll let that be a mystery.
But, it's the sort of game that does that to me, though, in that it wasn't doing anything interesting. It just had this fox and this, you know, go places and collect things kind of idea, and the jumping and the little puzzles, the platformy puzzles, they're competently done, but nothing more than that. And so I was just sort of frustrated with it because it was very pretty, but that didn't really get borne out by any substance, and I was really sort of not exactly losing my patience with it, but I was not having a good time, and time is such a sort of scarcity at the moment that I was kind of just, oh, come on, show me something.
It's interesting because it is gorgeous, but when I first looked at it, I thought you were playing Ori and the Blind Forest.
See, this is the thing. I was playing it and just there was nothing there that was... why I would be playing this and not Ori, apart from the fact that this hasn't made me want to put my controller through the window, whereas Ori very definitely did, because some of those sections were a right pain in the... I don't have a ball sack, but, you know.
The bushy tail.
Yes. And so I was kind of... I was not in a good place with it. And then it sort of... I don't know whether I mellowed or it changed slightly, because the story altered a little. You know, it did a little twist to the tale thing that you'd started to sort of suspect, I guess. But I think as well it's more that I'd acquiesced to being in that environment, and it still hasn't done much that's interesting, but some of the puzzles became slightly more interesting, because I've done this completely backwards and I haven't really explained anything about what you do. So I can do that now.
Well, it's a platformer, right? With...
So, well, yes, but the main, the unique thing for this is that you switch between the different seasons as you collect different spirits of the forest, essentially, and so you can gradually do more things. So for example, if you make it winter, then all of the water freezes, which means that you can use some like spouts of water and things as platforms to jump onto different levels, because when they're liquid you obviously, you know, just walk straight through them. And then there's also little touches, like when it's autumn, some of the when it's autumn, the little geezers that you can freeze to make platforms will only go to a certain height, whereas in spring they'll go all the way up, and so you can kind of create, you know, different levels of platform if you plan ahead. And then with summer, you know, there's other things that get introduced to this, so there is an element of playing with those with the seasons to actually solve puzzles and things. But I just couldn't shake the feeling that it was very much for children, and that it wasn't that nothing there was offering me a challenge, but it's the sort of thing that I'd maybe sit down with my niece or nephew in a few years' time, and that would be, you know, shall we go over here, or, you know, do you want to do the controls, or, you know, that kind of thing, rather than there wasn't much friction, essentially. Like, it hasn't pushed back much, and it's very beautiful, and I'm not objecting to it anymore, if that makes sense. Like, I'm not sat there sort of being annoyed by it, but there are just so many competent platformers, I guess, and the thing that sets this aside is the art style, and that's, you know, it's lovely, but without the, like, without any bite to the game, I'm really struggling to make it mean anything, or to make it anything more than that competent platformer, you know?
It's interesting because there's, like, sort of platformer with artistic sensibilities is, like, pretty much, like, the indie genre. Not that there's such a thing as an indie genre, because, you know, it's any type of game you want to make. But if you were going to, you know, a child's drawing of an indie game circa 2010 is a platformer that's also about, you know, death or bereavement or something.
Braid Light, isn't it?
Yeah, Braid, or you know, that sort of... And, you know, for whatever reason, that sort of bigger, like that 5 or 6 years ago, that big spike in attention being paid to indie centered around platformers quite a lot. And I hadn't thought about it until recently, that the kind of platformer structure, because it is often very samey. Even when platformers like have a twist, it's often the same twist. It's often something like you can change the state of the level to do something differently. It's seasons in this game, it's time in Braid, it's, you know, it's the dimensions in Fez. There's you know, it's the variations on very similar themes. And arguably the point of those games is to offer a little bit of resistance as you just experience an aesthetic thing, like a set of interesting pieces of art, dioramas. Monument Valley, even though it's not a platformer, is a movement-based, very simple puzzle game that is very low challenge, but is just 90% about how beautiful it is. And so I don't have an answer to this so much as to say, like, is there an argument for these games not being, challenges by design, but just being like moving, you know, paintings or a form of, you know, visual design that's closer to playing through a song, because you're just playing through this sort of thing with its own rhythms and stuff, and then it ends and there's no particular narrative.
But you'd still want the artwork and the experience of actually interacting with it to be related somehow. Whereas this feels like it's an incredibly beautiful environment, but the puzzles are pretty pedestrian, and the way it's laid out, you know, it's, I can hold it in my head quite easily because it is just quite simple, you know. So I don't know, I feel like that argument doesn't hold a lot of water, because I think that otherwise, I mean, you know, something, if you have to interact with it, that becomes part of the experience. And if that interaction isn't interesting or meaningful, then it doesn't exactly detract from the art itself, the art style. But I do think that it then divorces the two and the one part is really strong and the other part is just, you know.
Well, that maybe helps get towards like a sort of qualitative way of differentiating between games like this, because if you take Limbo, for example, like that is a game where, again, the mechanics of that game are very, very simple, but the, you know, the sense of danger that the mechanics create plays directly into the tone of the thing. Braid's puzzle solving mechanics are directly tied to the themes of Braid, and same with Fez and all the rest, like a lot of games like that. Maybe that's the line then, that like you can take beautiful art, but if you apply beautiful art to a very straightforward platformer, that's not enough to put you in that category. Would you think that's maybe a better way of differentiating between this game and other games that sort of attempted to do the same sort of thing?
Yeah, because I think that ultimately it feels a bit shallow, because you start to see the skeleton that it sits on isn't very rewarding or sort of interesting. So you'll sort of, you'll be drawn in by the visuals, because, you know, it, for example, if you're just sort of window shopping on Steam, you've got all of the thumbnails and things, and you've got, you know, the trailers and whatever, and so the visual style is actually going to do a lot for getting your attention and, you know, making you interested in playing the game. And so I have completely forgotten where I'm going with this, but I'm sure I had a point.
I wonder if it's a like a feedback problem. So there are lots of games that can look beautiful in a very kind of just picture perfect way, is that if you take a screenshot it'll look nice, but in terms of the way those visuals actually respond to your actions, it might actually be empty in the way that for example something like Rayman Legends is not. So Rayman Legends, the Rayman games, the new ones from Ubisoft, are absolutely extraordinarily colorful, beautiful environments all the time, but I play through all of them because simply moving around those worlds and watching things pop and having that sense of sudden great movement if I skid down a vine, and the way that the game rewards me actually pressing buttons in that game to do things is actually incredibly satisfying. And Ori is very good at that as well with its combat, actually giving you the poppy feedback. And it's not just about the picturesque, it's about actually what the game, how the game talks to you when you try and touch it.
Yeah.
Maybe, does this game have that, or is it just kind of, maybe that's...
There are flashes of it occasionally, mostly in the changing of the seasons, you know, because, but again, that's the artifacts, like, coming in. I don't think I've really found it with the interactions at all. They've all felt either just ordinary or slightly clunky, like the way that the fox jumps is ever so slightly not flowing enough, if you see what I mean. And so, you know, there's always just a slight catch, I find, that I see every time I jump as I run along. So I think it's a case of the game itself is beautiful, but it's like looking at a painting of a doll's house rather than a doll's house you can interact with and for that to be fun, you know? That's not a great analogy, but I seem to be really struggling to get into words the problem with something looking lovely. And I think it is just that it needs synergy, because an intrinsic part of gaming is that you need to interact with some systems, I think. Otherwise it is a movie, or it is, you know, a piece of just video art or installation or something like that. And, you know, there's no reason that they can't bleed into each other in some ways, and there will be stuff that exists at the crossover point, but this definitely isn't that. And so it needs to, or it needed to have more... just something in the mechanical side of it to make it marry up with the visuals. Otherwise you just look and you see it's doing this one thing really well, and then everything else is, you know, they could have plugged any art style into that, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
like
sure.
It feels like just a generic base game, and then, you know, you just sort of put any art style on top of it and it would have been interesting in a different way, or, you know, maybe something ugly, maybe something beautiful, maybe something highly stylized. But, you know, underneath it all is still that same bog standard box of tricks that isn't really doing anything for me.
That's a shame.
Alas. Until the next one, next week.
I haven't quite finished it, so there is obviously a chance that it will turn into, I don't know, the second coming of Dark Souls or, you know, I don't know.
Do you want to do a complete tonal U-turn, Tom?
Let's do it.
Talk about Battlefield 1.
From how's Battlefield?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Like, I find it curiously hard to have opinions about this game. And this is despite the fact that, so by a lot of accounts, Battlefield 1, which is an open beta at the moment, probably won't be by the time this podcast comes out, is like the first good Battlefield in a while. Like, to follow the narrative as it is commonly told, Battlefield 4 was pretty disappointing at launch and didn't get good until later. Battlefield 3 was good. Battlefront, Battlefield Hardline, which was the crime one.
Is that the one that massively misjudged the public tone for its marketing material?
Cops and Robbers turned out not to be a great song. Battlefront, which is not a Battlefield game, but fell in the was by the same developer and arrived in the Battlefield annual slot. And so now Battlefield 1, which is the World War 1 set traditional Battlefield game. And it's a strange, strange thing. And when the game was announced, we talked about it briefly and about the fact that World War 1 feels like a strange setting for a game in some ways. And it's a little bit more emotive in some ways. And I don't think there's a good reason for that. I don't think there's a good reason why I can look at hyper-violent pop culture versions of World War II and not bat an eyelid, but something about World War I makes me stop. And that's because there is no good reason for that. That is just the different ways that I've traditionally had that war, those two wars represented to me in culture over the last, you know, all of the years of my life.
I found that dissolved incredibly quickly when I started playing the game, because it was so fucking crazy that there was no way I could even associate
it. It still feels weird to me, and I think the reason it feels weird, and it comes for everything about the way that game is presented. So they sort of overhauled the front end of the game and done lots of things to that are good, like having a proper server list, which is something that more modern shooters need, and so on. But the front end is this sort of like lobby of, and it even calls it this, your battle experience. Like when you load in, the loading screen is like this sort of, well, it's the traditional Battlefield man who's half on fire. But what?
Why is he half on fire?
It's the Battlefield thing. He's always like a guy who's like half monochrome grey, half like there's a, like he's being underlit by like a fire or something.
Oh, I see.
It's just a Battlefield motif that's occurred in every game since 3. But in this case, it's like a really handsome, like young black World War I soldier, who's like turning to look at you with like a scowl on his face, and he looks like real cool,
like a hero,
in a way that no one in the trenches would have ever done. It's like a superhero, and he's turning to you, and all these loading screen messages pop up, which are like, populating global war lobby, getting your battle ready, customizing the experience. And it's all this like, it's like stepping into a car showroom for war. It's like this glittery.
I was gonna say, it's like when you go for a spa experience and you can customize your day and you can.
It's got a little bit of that to it. It's the sort of Apple Store, Apple of war.
God, yeah, the whole like, framing is very much like that.
It's very smooth and kind of crisp.
Yeah.
And it like pops up like, and the interface is very nice. But immediately it felt, this is a strange thing to have made, humanity. And then, you know, when you go to load into a game, it zooms out into a beautiful, crisp photo of the globe. And a bit weirdly like Street Fighter, which does the same thing, but that's, you know, that's what I think. And it says like, you know, finding game, whatever. And then you kind of like zoom in on the Sinai, which is the map for the open beta. And none of this has anything to do with what happens in the game, except that it feels strange. Maybe I'm starting to see games again, like people who don't play games all the time see games. But as a piece of fiction about a war, and I get that this is arriving after a decade of Call of Duties about modern war, which is even stranger in some ways. It just seems like a really fucking weird thing to have made. Like all of that presentation for a Star Wars game or for Titanfall or something like that, can pass me by and I won't even bat an eyelid because there's no real history bound up in it. It's not, this just feels like such a strange use of real events. But that is such a big point that it can't be pinned on this game alone. It's just this game. Something about this being at war that you're not often seeing in games, particularly in this way, made me freshly aware of how weird it is in every case, I think.
It was weird, even not detached from the World War One thing. It's like, it was welcome to the war playground, and here's the entire globe. It's this playground of war, and you're going to zoom in on the war, you know, the war bit that you want to war in, and that's going to be a fun experience for 40 minutes. And, yeah, Star Wars, that kind of works, but for even for a World War II game, that would be a bit weird. Feels almost like you're playing The Sims.
It does, yeah.
And then you're zooming into your neighbourhood where you do the fun times and tend to your kind of...
And this is the thing, because it has... It's super strange tonally, and it's really hard to pin down. So, like in my first game, I flew in a biplane, a triplane actually, the fighter, through the desert, nipped down through a sandstorm and shot a man off a horse. And... part of it, because it's set in, you know, the First World War, part of it has the tone of, like, proper old matinee adventure stuff. Even if you're talking about interwar kind of adventure stuff, it's got, like, maybe it's the desert setting of the first map helps this, but it's got that kind of, like, weird Indiana Jones, almost a Western, because a lot, you know...
It's really pulpy, isn't it? It's really pulpy.
1914, 1915, 1916 is within the timeline to be very late weapon, late cowboy western in terms of weaponry.
Horses riding alongside trains evokes the heist thing as well. Like, yeah, definitely.
It's got this sort of strange amalgamation of all that stuff. And, I mean, you know, you and I were listening to history podcasts about, you know, turn of the century. American history relatively recently, and that whole era of warfare is really interesting, and I'm you know, not represented in games very often, like the fact that until the First World War, maybe different points of different nations, this was the end of, like, war's a great big jolly in some ways, and, you know, famously that's one of the attitudes going into First World War that was massively criticized afterwards. So it has that feeling of it. It's almost like that kind of jingoism, the game, right? Like, it's it's, you know, like, literally people in, you know, people in America in the late 19th century going and rounding up cowboys to go to war in Cuba. And it's, you know, it's from that same sort of era, which it's not doing that on purpose, but it has something of that to it. But at the same time, it includes, like, all of the iconic World War One things, like mustard gas.
Yeah.
And so you press T to put your gas mask on. And while you've got your gas mask on, you can't scope. You can't hard scope while you're wearing a gas mask and your vision's limited. But it makes you immune to AOE damage over time gas.
Yeah.
And that's maybe that's just a specifically strange thing because so much of the horror of World War One is represented pretty much by gas.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's like sort of like horrific war crime simulator 9000 in some ways. Not that they're not generally.
Oh God. Yeah, I think it's bad if you've read or heard anything about what it might have actually been like for the people involved.
Yeah, but this is the
but again, it's like a surrounding culture. It's not the game. Like, the game is just, it's a big silly game. But
yeah.
Nonetheless, it kind of triggers all these things. Like, I tell one of the worst stories I've heard about gas masks and people ripping them off each other's faces when they're in a bunker and they know the gas is coming in. Like, it's some of the most awful stuff you can read about. And now it's a fucking power-up in the game. Yeah. And it's like, they're just making war entertainment that people have made for decades, but it still has that emotional...
I think that's a surprising consequence of the relatively novel setting, is it makes all that stuff fresh.
Yeah.
Because there is horror in every kind of war, and you don't really necessarily think about it. And then... games like, you know, Fallout make a kind of a running joke out of the aftermath of nuclear explosions, and that's one of the most horrific things that has been dealt with. Far more sensitive. Like, you know, we're kind of used to it in other contexts. That, at least, is not a point you can really drive home. The game itself is actually kind of interesting, because detached from that, it's using the trappings of World War One to solve loads of problems with Battlefield at once. I think. Like, because the guns are shit, so the sniping thing isn't as big an issue, because no one can fucking hit anybody. But everyone's a sniper, that's still the case. Everyone's a sniper all of the time.
Yeah.
Because it's a Battlefield game. But the sort of drama of them missing and assault troops rushing up and taking the objectives and stuff is sort of still actually quite exciting.
Hmm.
And everything looks and sounds spectacular because it always does. Yeah. Like, DICE are good at that and they're still good at that and it looks amazing. And, you know, earlier I was like defending a canyon behind a sandbag and leaning up with my rifle and firing shots at British soldiers coming up the valley. And then two dudes and two British soldiers, as might have happened in the war, base jumped off the top of the cliffs ahead on top of us, parachuted into the valley, bayoneted everybody, but then were cut down by a man on a horse.
Yeah.
Because that's how that kind of thing that happens in World War One. But yeah, so the guns being really inaccurate gives it a sense of, like, the ballistics itself is part of the game.
Hmm.
And sometimes you can't hit someone who's standing 3 feet from you because everything's kind of rubbish and there's loads of horizontal recoil, which feels really weird.
Hmm.
And it feels very kind of chaotic, but in a quite a good way. I think maybe after a while you might get frustrated that you can line up a shot and miss, but at the moment, at least, it feels like a skill ceiling thing rather than a pure kind of chaos thing. It feels like the first time they've fixed planes since Battlefield 1942 or 1943 when they did the re-release. World War One planes are slow and shit. Therefore they're not too fast for the maps, which is the old jet problem, or you have the absurdly slow jet.
Yeah.
They're open topped, which creates interesting opportunities for other characters to be sniped out of them and for things like that to happen. And they are not like there are three. There's a fighter that specializes in taking down other planes. There's an attack plane with big heavy guns in the front, and there's a bomber that can drop bombs. And all of them are like good at the thing they do, but they're not so good at it that they sort of counteract the others. But the flip side of that is there aren't very many easily accessible anti-aircraft weapons for people on the ground. Not every soldier is holding a Stinger missile launcher, which is the traditional thing.
Yeah.
And so, and there are flat cannons, but they're in specific parts of the map, and you've got to go capture them if you want to use them. And so for that reason, and the same is actually true of tanks. Like, not everyone can deal with a tank when it's rolling in. And it's actually called a landship, which is nice.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you have to go capture something. And so what they've succeeded in doing, I think, is slowing the pace of the game really, really far down relative to where it was. And I enjoyed just cruising around a little plane, taking down other, you know, getting in dogfights and stuff. And it felt good. And that felt, and also the spawning system for it's much better. There's, your team has a limited stock of aircraft. And if one of that stock is available when you are getting ready to respawn, you can choose what plane you want and then spawn in that.
Yeah.
And then when you're down, you're stuck. So there's no queuing for respawn because either available. And you could sit there on the loading screen and wait for someone to die, but you're better off not, really. There's certainly no waiting back at base for the plane to physically respawn on the map.
No, well, that does have to be solved.
Yeah, so that's really good. So those sort of things are all positive step forwards, actually. And I've had, you know, like a reasonable amount of fun with it, I think. But you bounced a little bit harder, I think.
Yeah, I hated it. Absolutely hated it. And not for any like tonal reasons at all. It looks spectacular, and the explosions feel amazing, and it, you know, the battlefield looks incredible. But I think it was a consequence of both the mode and the map, and in the Conquest, which is basically a capture point map on an open sandbox area, with I think there are like five or six capture points in this particular quite large map, just felt like there was absolutely no kind of rhyme or rhythm to the push or pull between the two teams on the map in terms of capture or recapture or where the fronts were or where the fights were supposed to be happening or what was actually important on the map. And I always like to know what I'm kind of supposed to be doing at any given point. And I don't need too much direction, but what I found with Battlefield 1 is that you just spawn on the place that seems nearest to the place where your friends are, nearest to the enemy, and then you kind of charge in and see what happens. And that's probably a terrible way to play it, but I didn't understand how else I could play it and what the hell the fuck I was supposed to be doing at any given point anywhere. As an infantry person, you're so exposed and you have so little power against tanks. Like, if you see a tank, you just gotta run away. That it felt like a game of just total chance. sometimes a sandstorm would roll in, and then you'd walk into a crater, and then you'd get shot from the left, and then you'd respawn, and the sandstorm had cleared, and you go into a building, and you shoot out a trip mine, and that's great, but then you get, you know, someone snipes you through a window from a completely different house, and all the points are super close together compared to Conquest maps in previous games. And it was just absolute nonsense. Like, it was no drama to it after a while, because it was just running around aimlessly. Sometimes I'd get lucky and kill someone. Sometimes I'd get unlucky and get killed. Often, like every time, from someone I hadn't even seen. And part of that is map knowledge. Part of that is getting back into the rhythm of the game. But I think the map in particular and the way that mode worked was just terrible.
I think they haven't solved the problem with Conquest that Conquest had for a long time, which is that it is just a sort of war soup.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. And you duck into it and it'll always look spectacular. And it's spectacular because everyone's fighting a different battle. Mm. Like, the guy on the plane's doing a bit different to the guy on the ground, the sniper's doing a bit different to the guy next to you. And with a big team or something, or you're playing with all your friends, then you can make some structure out of that, but there's no structure for anybody, really. Everyone's just sort of, like, vaguely trying to wrestle the points in their team's direction.
And there's a game that does that really well, and it's called Call of Duty. But with Call of Duty, everyone's expected to be a lone wolf, essentially, and the maps are designed in that way in order to, you know, be small and, you know, understandable after just a few playthroughs. Whereas a Conquest map the map knowledge was going to take longer to acquire. And as you say, the weapons are so inaccurate that even if you do get into good positions, there's no guarantee that you won't be outgunned by someone with the same weapon as you.
I find that the best way to enjoy that part of the game, and this hasn't changed from Battlefield to Battlefield, is kind of to be selfish. Like, so they're back up to 64 player games. And with that many players, there's a lot less pressure on the individual to do stuff. Obviously, if you want to win, then probably doing the right stuff. But actually, as you say, it's almost impossible to figure out exactly what that is.
Yeah.
Half the time. So I see that mode as like, just do the thing that interests you about that setting and the game becomes a lot better. And I wonder if that's, you know, Battlefront as well, the Star Wars game, they started to think about, I think, designing these games in a hyper casual way. And this maybe ties back to that Apple Store kind of intro, is if you want to be a plane and fly around and get into dogfights and fly into a sandstorm and it's a bit like The Mummy, then you can do that. And if you want to lie on a hilltop and fiddle with the zeroing settings on your old-timey sniper rifle and try and plonk bullets into people as they run past and just wait up there for ages, you can do that. If you want to, you know, drive around in a tank or a jeep or whatever, or, you know, crawl across the dunes with a carbine, then you can do all that stuff as well. And that's, I think, okay. Like, I quite enjoy it for that, because I, relative to other FPSs that I play, compared to something like Overwatch, where it's the opposite of Overwatch, because in Overwatch, you know, there's only six of you on the team and each of you got a specific role. And if you're not doing the thing that you're supposed to be doing, you're going to lose. And if you lose, kind of what was the point? Whereas this is like, all I want to do is lie on a hill and fire this cool sounding gun and maybe I'll hit somebody. And like, searching for meaning in that, or like a greater sense of strategic purpose, is probably folly, I suspect. But that's why you've got Rush. Sorry, Pip, you're saying?
No, I was just going to make a facetious remark that perhaps you could channel all of this into a think piece about how well it models the futility and the stupidity and the lack of direction of the First World War, and the fact that points would be taken and retaken, and it was just a war of attrition at various points. So, yeah,
I said on Twitter, like, oh, I was moaning about the map and saying it feels really directionless and then there aren't any fronts and it's just kind of chancy. And just random stuff happening, and people are like, oh, sounds a lot like the First World War.
Yeah.
And I was like, actually, the First World War had incredibly well-defined rights. Yes,
it was two lines. I mean, the similarity.
They took and retook the same hills over and over and over.
A lot of snipers.
I'd counter that, that inevitable op-ed, which someone will write for money. I would say that actually, so in the middle of this, this game, because we were winning, the enemy team got a train. The train drove right into the middle of the map and then it stopped. And the train had four or five giant cannons on it. And the giant cannons started rotating and shooting things like Daleks. And then I thought, I know how I'll defeat this train. I'll run right up to it so the turrets can't aim down at me, and I'll squat amongst its tracks. I'll shoot everyone that comes out like a dickhead. And at this point, any sort of war or comparison that you could make in any context has just been completely dissolved. It's just it's total nonsense. It doesn't emulate anything about the futility or the of taking or retaking points. It's just, I think, badly designed map that is really frustrating and annoying to play. And a shooter, like, it's hard to find a kind of sandbox experiential experience in a shooter, because it's so inherently competitive and about capturing points, and you're constantly being rewarded and given points for shooting people and standing on points, that kind of has to be the point of it in some way. And you're right, Chris is right, that Rush is always been the best Battlefield mode anyway, and I've not played Rush in Battlefield
1. It's yet. A lot better.
And like, yeah, I'm sure it would be a lot better.
So the other thing I wanted to say, so in Rush, because they couldn't, so they've struggled a bit for trying to find old timey analogies for stuff that was in other Battlefield games.
Oh yeah, so it can't be a little kind of communications.
It's station. A telegraph.
That's awesome.
You've got to blow up the telegraph.
All right.
Can't
replace the telegraph. Well, it's technology far beyond us.
They're in two sets of two, like the MCOM stations.
That's really funny.
There's like loads of sets of two as you go through. And the map actually works a lot better in that way, because it takes you through it in modular, ends in the town. Starts in the ruins and ends in the town. And that actually is quite good fun. You know, it starts off good for snipers and ends terrible for snipers because of the city streets and stuff.
Yeah.
And it ends in such a mental kind of place. Like, we were losing hard as on the defending team. We got back to the last telegraph, which is just a little radio in a house, and we've got to defend it. And by the end of it, the destructibility's back, which is great. A bit more like Bad Company.
Yeah, so that's great.
The walls have just been ripped off that house. Like, multiple British tanks have rolled in, tried to destroy it, and been blown up. Because obviously you can't destroy the radio, the tiny radio, by firing a tank shell at it.
No.
A man has to go up to it and put a bomb on it, which can then be removed.
Invincible telegraphs.
Yeah. But like, at one point, like, all the walls had been blown out on the building, and my team had parked a tank in the building next to the telegraph, just kind of like guarding it. And I was a medic running around my carbine trying to help people, getting some kills and stuff. And then it got to the point where their team had like 8 tickets left, so they can lose 8 people and the game is over. And the weather effects are really good, and it had gotten like wet and smoky and dusty, and it's like visibility is really low. And I'm running along, and an enemy comes in just using a horse for transport, jumps off the horse, goes for the telegraph and dies. So I run for the horse. I get on the horse, and if you get on a horse, the horse gives you a sword.
Really?
Yeah.
The horses just stop completely still when their rider's been shot off, and then anyone can claim them, which is how horses work.
Yeah, exactly. You can claim the horse. And then I went charging off into the smoke, and this horse, right as like the last, probably the last wave of enemies came in. And the sword is the deadliest weapon in that game. It's like a one-hit kill at speed from a horse. And so I just like rode in this big circle around the telegraph, waving a sword. Like sweeping it down, and I got like 3 kills or something, which you know wasn't the worst we recently won, but it was definitely like a big momentum shift that like the next 3 kills were dead easy, and then my team kind of clutched it from the jaws of defeat. And it was nothing like World War One, but it was quite fun. And that couldn't happen in a previous Battlefield game because there was no horse equivalent. Also, when you're killed by a man on a horse with a sword, the thing you were killed by on the kill feed is horse, which completely misunderstands the deadly part of that arrangement.
But the horse gave you the sword, so the horse clearly has to claim
it. It's like a kind of World War One NRA thing, which is like swords don't kill people,
horses do.
But like,
I'll play it. I'll play it for that nonsense, I suppose.
Horses can kill people.
They can, but in that instance, it was the man.
Maybe you
with the
trampled
sword.
Them. Maybe you thought you sworded them, but it was a one shot trample kill.
It's definitely the sword.
I'm a bit nostalgic for Bad Company 2's Rush, which is just was incredible.
It's still the best Battlefield game.
Yeah, and people are still playing it, and it's cheap. So if you like good Battlefield games and good Rush, then Bad Company 2, very, 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 very good.
Final thing I'd like to say about Battlefield 1 is that, and I imagine they were, you know, restricted by history in this, but World War 1 was before the same military phonetic alphabet that every military game uses.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have Alpha, Bravo. It has apples and butter, which is the most adorable thing.
Yeah, I love they did that.
In the world. And it's Alpha, Butter. And so it's apples, Butter, Charlie. And Charlie's the same. I can't remember what D is.
No.
And then it's, I think it's Frederick and George.
Like, what's E? Is that Eric?
I can't remember. Unfortunately, I can't remember. But for the rush mode, the two objectives in each phase are always A and B.
Yeah.
And you have this very, like, there's a sort of soft-spoken, sad soundy. She sounds muted, like, you know, war is hell. The British woman who'll be go, apples is under attack. We've lost objective butter. And that's the best thing in that game. It was the first thing I heard when I joined the game is, you know, you can be assigned, in Conquest, you can be assigned orders by your squad leader and it'd be like, attack, objective, George.
I like the idea of objective butter, implying that there's subjective, like, you know, instead of salted and unsalted.
Margarine is subjective butter.
I can't believe it's not butter.
Yeah, actually, whether or not you believe it's butter, indeed. It isn't butter. It is objectively
not butter.
Not butter.
Yeah.
But yeah.
God. Anyway.
Attack subjective butter.
Did you want to talk more on Battlefield?
No.
Or shall we do some questions?
Let's do some questions instead.
Yes.
Jacob writes, dear Space Crate and needlessly complex sci-fi crowbar alternative, how long do you think it'll take after Star Citizen's general release for all conceivable Firefly references to be mined for usernames? On a more serious note, given the high real-world price of ships, particularly multi-crew ones, it seems unavoidable and almost encouraged that people will band together to buy them. Are there plans for or already systems in case co-owners fall out? Or would anything like that have to be settled in the real world? Could there even be some kind of in-game prenup? Like a co-ownership contract to save Cloud Imperium's ass when someone inevitably loses their stake in a multi-£1,000 ship due to a falling out and decides to sue the company. Sorry if it's a bit of a dry question or answered already. Watching the demo described last week, well, 2 weeks ago, I guess, was the first I've seen of this game, and digital ownership has always been kind of fuzzy, even when it's not potentially split between players in this way. Thanks for reading, Jacob.
I think you'd sue your friends, not Cloud Imperium, over that one, because it would be them that dicked you over.
Mm.
Especially if it's not a service that's even offered by Cloud Imperium.
That service isn't offered by them, and in any case, I imagine if you dug into the EULA for that game, you'd not even own the ship, so you probably couldn't even say you sue your friends.
Yeah.
Because one person is renting use of a part of a piece of software.
So you'd be trying to sublet a spaceship.
Yeah, essentially, it's a subletting agreement. And
basically, literally, no one has any rights in this situation. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
And I don't think they're going to get them either. Like, no one's going to. It seems unlikely. I mean, this is an interesting kind of addendum to the discussion we're having at the start of the pod, because this is also about, you know, ownership and what you can expect from a developer and so on. Particularly when money's being asked for. In this case, a lot of money for an internet spaceship. But I don't think that is a use of that service that Cloud Imperium anticipate from conversations I've had with them and what I know about their community. That's a hobby game where people buy the big thing because they want the big thing. And actually, I hadn't even considered that people might go in for shares on a multi-crew ship before this question, actually. And it makes sense because it's expensive stuff and it's supposed to be something you fly with your friends. But I don't think they've anticipated it, and I don't think they will do anything to support it, because even if there's no sort of like legal side to it, the dispute arbitration aspect of that is a actual nightmare.
Yeah, if they were to introduce an in-game way of doing this, that they would be like opening themselves up to all sorts of nightmarish like disputes, not even in courts, but just in-game terms.
Can you imagine it though? Like, if people had a falling out, but they didn't want to give up their bit of the ship, so like maybe the answer is that Cloud Imperium invent like in-game yellow tape that you can use to mark out your section, and no one's allowed to come over that line.
I think maybe people just need to not throw lots of money away.
Seems Isn't to be that the running theme of the podcast?
It might be, yeah. Just like, if the thing you're doing with your money on the internet with a game feels like it might be a giant, well, at least leave you vulnerable to losing all of that money and getting nothing for it, then it seems increasingly necessary to make your peace with that's what you're doing. Not even the you know, wise idea that accept that what you're buying is what you get now. Mm. But accept that what you're buying might be nothing at all.
Yeah. If you see a potentially...
Moon dust, or whatever it is.
Even the potential for incredibly convoluted legal suit in the future around an entertainment product, maybe just play a different game.
Go for the simple option, which is either just, you know, God, are we going to end up with people buying those ships, but then like selling rides on them? Like, I'll let you fly it around, let you sublet it from me. Like, that's actually...
This would be like how my brother used to make money back on his N64. I paid him 20p an hour.
How many times did you complete Ocarina
of Time? Monstrous, brother.
That's just... Because I also worked out how to, when he was out, to use his N64 and then put it back exactly the same way as when he'd left it. Because he would check. But I would like measure everything and make sure that if there was anything that was resting on it, that I knew to put it back in the exact position. And if in doubt, you'd like let the cat into the room so that it, you know, you could just say, well, clearly the cat did it. Like, I haven't touched your poxy console. Why would I want to?
Did you set up an independent arbitration court to actually resolve?
Did you sue Nintendo?
Well, my mother, but my mother was just like, well, it's his console. I was just like, oh, this is everything that's wrong with capitalism.
It is.
So.
I doubt there'll be any, like, discreetly returning your mate's £1,000 spaceship and
with making, a ding on it.
Joyriding it, letting the cat in. The cat did it. Yeah, I don't know.
If you have one of these stories, tell PC Gamer because we'll probably write about it. It sounds hilarious.
Yeah. Definitely don't tell Rock Paper Shotgun. Tell PC Gamer and only PC Gamer.
I'm just sending out superiority vibes so that people feel...
That's what they were.
They trust me and come to me with their hot scoops.
The hot scoops.
Lovely
and their
scoop.
Hot rods. That's what people call fast cars, is it not?
Yes, it is. Why is that relevant?
Well, because these are vehicles and they probably go fast because they're in space. No friction. Vroom.
Indeed. Yeah.
What?
Why not?
I get a hot take with my hot scoops in my hot rod.
The model journalist.
Yeah.
I've completely lost my thread now. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yes.
Thanks, Pip.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Well, it was mostly just this is hilarious.
Mm.
That was your closing thought, I believe.
What a band.
Although it does make me curiously a bit more interested in Star Citizen. Now I'm sort of viewing it as a weird sort of road movie.
It's not though, is it?
People club together to put like fiver in for petrol and try to get to Vegas to stop a wedding. What? Anyway.
If it was, it would be a different game.
I mean, play that game though.
Yeah. That's the version of Star Citizen.
It would basically be rom-coms the MMO, right?
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. I don't
know. Could you do an MMO of a rom-com? Because they're so act-based, right? Like,
but those would be all your quests, right? You'd have quest lines to fulfill all of the bits of Jennifer Aniston's journey from being a florist to being a florist with a boyfriend.
But... So, I mean, you know, we've traced over the course of many films the particular rhythm of a Lindsay Lohan movie, and I appreciate this is off Star Citizen.
Right.
But that particular rhythm, which involves the beginning of the movie where Lindsay Lohan is shamed, and the end of the movie where Lindsay Lohan is redeemed, thanks to probably like Paul Rudd or somebody.
Yeah.
And that reoccurs. I don't necessarily
McFly
see the
McFly in one case.
Or in some cases McFly. I don't really see the potential for an MMO style character arc there. It's more like a Metroidvania.
But it's
you lose
you
all
know,
your powers at the beginning and then you have
imagine,
to unlock all the different Rudds
right.
to open the different Rudd doors.
Imagine if Jennifer Lopez was just the same character in all of those films. It's just one woman with a lot of different jobs.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying. Like, that pretty much is the plot of Metroid.
But, yeah, well, so I haven't played Metroid. So I don't actually know whether I used the word Metroidvania accurately earlier, but I was just kind of hoping that I would gloss over that. But now it feels like a good time to come clean. But like, in an MMO, you've essentially got a lot of jobs, right? You're fetching, you're carrying, you're telling people things, you're a postman, you're a woodcutter.
One of those things was a job. The rest of those things were active actions.
Woodcutter.
Okay, so he slipped in at the end.
Fetching.
Fetching is not a job.
But, like, it could be. Courier.
Yeah, but that...
Yeah, but, like, you know, Hogger will send you to do... whatever, like pick up a mushroom or whatever. That's mushrooming, right? That's a job, sure. Probably.
Sure. I would definitely...
French rural countryside, as opposed to the urban countryside. Anyway.
I'd take the point that an MMO character necessarily does a lot of different tasks for people.
Yeah, so maybe you'd start off with your like, low-level rom-com quest line, you know? Where you just have to sort of get off with the mildly annoying but handsome guy who's pulled your hair at school kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you maybe level up a few times by going on dates with him, and then you realise, you know, like it chains into the next boyfriend where he suddenly becomes the douchebag, you know? You don't get your happily ever after, and suddenly you're, you know, a photographer or a wedding planner, and then you now, because of your changing circumstances and his changing level of douchebaggery, You now are susceptible to the advances
of a level 15 dire rud.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. I don't know how we got onto this. I sort of see where you're coming from, though. Now better than I did before.
Yeah. You know,
world of what would this be called?
I don't know.
Then shit.
Romomocom. I don't know. I don't know. What? I had the idea. I don't have to come up with the name. Hearts.
I think possibly we've meandered from...
World of Lovecraft. Wait, no. That's probably too many tentacles.
Don't even...
That would be niche.
Less niche than you think.
Really?
I think...
How niche? Is this like bronies? There's like a whole secret thing.
Oh no. We're not going through this again.
Okay. Sorry.
I think possibly we got a bit far from... The potential legal ramifications of multi-person ship ownership in the internet computer video game Star Citizen. But sorry. I hope we answered a question.
Yeah.
Or maybe even just prompted some questions.
Just kind of circled it really. And
rom.com.
That would be
the website, wouldn't it?
We're sorry, Jacob. Like thank you for writing in.
CDROM.com.
Oh, God. Once again, Jacob, thank you for writing in. We're very sorry about where we took this.
I'm not.
Daniel writes, Dear Aberrant Cowcard, which apparently is an anagram.
Oh.
What do you do during in-engine cutscenes, a la Half-Life? Role play as the character engaged in the conversation, spin in circles, jump on furniture? Is a cutscene a satisfactory solution to stop the player crouch-walking into the legs of NPCs? Is silliness the price of player freedom? Thanks as always, Daniel.
Anything that makes it look like I'm thrusting, really. Or lunging. Thrusting or lunging or dancing.
Just really getting into people's personal space, you know, when you could just press your face right up against theirs as they're trying to exposit, just trying to deliver some plot. Jumping up and down, throwing things. Of course, Half-Life 2 is great for that. I can't remember a time where I've actually role-played and stood still and just let it happen. But having said that, I would rather be given the chance to play around and be free and mess around than actually just watch somebody's film in the middle of a video game.
Predictably, I'm boring. I like
you
to try
role play.
No, not really role play. I like to like sort of do the cinematic camera myself. I like to move around the room like I was really in there. It's interesting to me.
Oh wow. Okay.
I just like to know that I like to do what the character would do, which is often look.
Sometimes I deliver my own monologue louder than they are. Like, I'll stand opposite and then I'll just say all of the things that come into my head really loudly to drown them out. But then I realise that I've missed all of the cutscene and I don't know what's going on because I was talking about what I had for dinner or like singing the lyrics of, I don't know, something, but like probably Love Shack, you know.
Not again.
Or like, you know, delivering it as a dramatic monologue. I do that with the theme tune of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Mm.
But, like, change it slightly so that it sounds a bit more like my life story and how, you know... what? And how I wasn't doing amazingly at school, so my parents decided it would probably be for the best if I went to stay with some relatives for a little while. You know, they were out of town and... You know.
So, you know, you've said on a couple of occasions that you struggle to remember the plots of games. Is this not a memory problem, like you would put it down to, but in fact because you're shouting the Fresh Air Prince and Blair theme at the game for the entire duration of the story?
Well, I think it's hard to determine cause and effect, really, isn't it? Like, some things are... that happen before, and some things that happen afterwards... I think essentially I realised that I wasn't going to remember any of this, so I might as well do something that I enjoyed. You know, I'm not going to remember a bus ride or an explanation that a man gives me while standing looking slightly through my head. I mean, you know, who does?
I always like games that have zoom functions.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah, they're great, and you can really... Especially if they're opening their mouths, you can look inside the mouths, like you just zoom right
or
in.
Or their ear.
Or the ear, and just be like, how, to what extent have you, like, is there a tongue in there actually wagging around? And some games do that. Sometimes they go,
what's good
something.
Is if you've got a gun with like a scope, so you can zoom in, you know, really close on their eye or something.
Yeah, I love doing that.
And just like watch their one eye as they tell you everything.
And they're like, Jensen, what are you doing? Jensen, no, what did, Jensen. Go over there.
Yeah. Or try and nudge them.
Oh, yeah. That's actually... Yeah. Like, a load of speedrunners do that in Half-Life 2. They pick up boxes and they put them kind of into people's faces as they talk and it skips the cutscene along.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's how speedrunners get through those segments.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's great. So they're basically they're just beyond us, Pip, in our experimental state. You know, at one point they discovered that if you put a box in someone's face, they stop explaining things boringly to you and just skip to the next bit.
You should try that in the pod.
Did I tell you about Eternal Sonata?
Hang on, get a box.
Oh. No, this is relevant.
Okay.
As in, I know it's a console game, but it has really long, like it's sort of a JRPG about Chopin's death.
Yeah.
But it also has these, like, photo, what are they called? Like, slideshows, at the end of each segment, just about Chopin's life. And so, like, I think you can skip them, but I didn't realise this, and they go on for a fucking long time. So I would go off and start making dinner during them. Mm. So that's another use of your time during a cutscene, is to actually just go off and start making a lasagna, because the game won't shut up about Chopin.
You ate, like, four lasagnas in 2 hours watching playing this game. It's like, man,
just like,
why am I so full?
You know, it's in the freezer. Like, I can't shut it. Did we answer another question?
I think we just did answer a question.
Yay!
I think another might be a bit strong.
Oh, well, I thought by saying it we'd make it so.
John Roberts, frequent pod guest, writes, what items or locations have you personified due to their mechanics? My Subnautica base was a grumpy old bastard. If I worked the crafting station too hard, the base would shut down and stop producing oxygen. Until I fed the reactor some fish. Cheers. I like that your thought when you have a grumpy thing that stops working unless you feed it fish is that that's a humanizing characteristic. Or that he'll suffocate you somehow if you don't give him a fish.
It's a very specific bastard. It's more of a cat character.
Mm. Like a grumpy cat.
Yeah.
That will suffocate you.
Yeah. They suffocate babies.
What, really?
Well, you're not supposed to put them in the cot with the baby in case the cat falls asleep on the baby's face.
That's not the same as a cat, like, deliberately suffocating a baby because that's given enough fish.
Well, no.
A nightmarish image of a cat just putting its paws over a baby's mouth and actually just so kind of...
The cat just comes over with a little pillow.
Jesus Christ.
So dark, I love it.
Oh, God. In terms of the question...
Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
To pay even minor lip service.
I've never had it with, like, a bass or any a big system like that, but I was freaked out by the Mace of Moloch Baal from, I think it was Oblivion. You'd find this evil mace in someone's basement, and it had a giant face in it that was always looking at you, like a skull face.
I don't remember that.
And then you hit people with it, and it kind of stole their soul. And it, like, sucked energy out of them. The idea was that it held all these souls inside it. And that became a character for me, even though it never said anything, it never did anything, but it was really powerful and I always used it.
Yeah.
And it changed my playthrough a lot. I basically became a lot more evil because, like, it's impossible not to be evil. If you're doing a good deed with that thing, it immediately becomes a morally complicated deed.
Oh, wow.
So it corrupts everything.
So was it sucking out their souls to refill those soul gems that you would get? Or was it just to, like, feast on for its own purposes?
I think it was for its own purposes.
Oh.
It was a hungry, hungry mace. Many lasagnas were consumed.
Wow.
Course of Oblivion.
Really want to go back and find that now.
Mm.
Or check whether I've got it and really don't remember.
It's pretty hard to miss. It glows bright green and has a big face in it. It's good.
Pip?
What?
You did a face like you had. You
I was
say
looking
something.
Encouraging. I mean, I don't think I've ever had this, and that's weird because I anthropomorphize everything.
Mm, I was going to say.
But I don't think I'd do it with bases or anything because they're kind of collections of objects. Like I might do it with
it's more
know.
About mechanics, right? It's more about
you
know, items or locations, I guess. So
yeah, I think I don't ever see games in quite that way. Like if I had we've got a kettle that leaks ever so slightly, and for me that's like a tiny part of its personality, you know.
Mm.
But
that it's shit.
Well, yes. But like, you know, it's kind of like, it's complicated and I don't want to explain it because I think that people probably already think less well of me, than they did at the beginning of the podcast. But, it works with real life things because they actually sort of change over time or you get used to them or you know, you have particular relationships with them because of how they actually fit into your life. Whereas in games, I don't think I've ever felt that anything was permanent enough or real enough to make that the case.
Mm. I think, well, I mean, I invest a lot imaginatively in games, but it tends to be in like the people that associate with items and places rather than the items and places themselves. Like, I don't really see systems in that way. So I guess this question is a no for me as well. Simply because if I have, like, a cool base or a cool item or some sort of thing that I've made, I'll think more about how that reflects the character I'm playing or the characters that might live there or something than I will about, I don't know, personifying the thing itself. I mean, there are exceptions that I kind of quite like there's a great... you know, the fuck you, I'm the Mako gif has sort of set the personality of Mass Effect's tank for me. And that's based entirely on its mechanics, like the dumb floatiness and the fact that it's this strange frictionless battle pod that bounces around these alien landscapes. And again, it's otherwise quite grounded and sort of things. The idea it's got a mind of its own kind of definitely fits in that particular case, but I can't say that's something I've invented for it because that's the internet men and their many good jokes.
Yeah. I think maybe another part of it is that I find that I get it more when there's idiosyncrasy.
Mm.
So, for example, when there's not, you know, like if you have to jiggle the lock a certain way on your house to get in, that's a thing that marks it as yours, and you get used to exactly how it feels. Or, you know, if there's particular quirks of how you operate something, or, oh, you need to do this first, or, you know, like the ways that you learn to trick your toaster into doing your bidding, you know?
Like, what have you been doing to the toaster?
Well, no, but just, you know, like I've had a toaster in the past where it wouldn't catch the first time, so you had to, you know, do a particular thing to make it actually...
Yeah, I suppose games don't really ever do flaws like that.
It's more that if something's a bug, then you try and fix it rather than live with it and have it become part of the experience of the thing.
Mm.
Or the developer will try and fix it if enough people have it, but either way it doesn't quite have that same effect. I guess maybe the only exception to that I can think of is games like Factorio or something, where you build a machine and you actually try and get it to run a certain way. So maybe if you kept misunderstanding how you'd laid it out and kept having it not being efficient, you know, you'd sort of start having that. From what John said, it sounds like that sort of relationship that you almost have with, I don't know, with a car when you're trying to fix it or something, and you get really frustrated and you try and make it do your bidding when it doesn't want to, or you have to take certain other things into account, like time, or, you know, just needing to sort of treat it in a particular way, like rev it up or warm it, or, you know, all of those kinds of things. Whereas... So maybe with something more in that vein, like you've built a machine and you're trying to get it to work a certain way.
Well, that's where this started, with the Subnautica base, right?
Yeah, but that's why I was thinking maybe that's why that example.
Mm. I think that's all the questions we've got time for. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can email us at questions@greatandcrowbar.com. You can tweet us a question @greatandcrowbar. You can leave a question on the forum at creatingcrowbar.com/forum, and you can discuss this episode on our Discord channel. There's a link in the show notes at creatingcrowbar.com, and also on the sidebar of the website with the same address as the one I just said. Also, if you like, you can follow us as individuals. I'm @cthurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I'm @PCGLudo, which is LUDO.
And I'm @PhilippaWarr, which is PhilippaWarr.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Everybody.